Dear supporters of BLC, if you adore BLC and our free Black History and audiobook content, donate via Patreon or get a print copy of the world-famous art pieces, The Marrow of Tradition by Charles Chestnut and Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, bound together into just one practical book. The Marrow of Tradition by Charles Chestnut and Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, bound together into just one practical book. In the link below.
We're going to have conflict after conflict, and all of my words calling for nonviolence will fall on many deaf ears. And so often our white brothers have not realized the gravity of this problem. It is the fact that the Negro finds himself perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. We're the richest nation in the world. This year our national gross product will go up to the astounding figure of $650 billion. Yet about 50% of the Negro families of our country are categorized as poverty-stricken. They find themselves hovered up in teeming ghettos. They feel cut off from the mainstream of American life and the cities in which they live. So often they don't make enough money to support their families. This accounts for a great deal of the disintegration of the family life within the Negro community. The Negro man, by and large, has never been able really to be a man. And the Negro family has been, by and large, a matriarchal family, not a patriarchal family. And this has deprived the man of his manhood, and so often out of frustration and self-hatred and inability to support his family, looking at six and seven and eight children across the table and can't support them, he deserts the family. And then comes the problem of desertion on the one hand and illegitimacy on the other. It becomes a strange and tragic cycle. We must not overlook the economic basis of this tragic problem growing out of the legacy of slavery and segregation. And it is a serious problem. We must face the fact that 42% of the Negro families of our country still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 16% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 20% of the Negro families of our country earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. This is a tragic economic gulf. It makes for many social problems. I've just left Los Angeles, as I said earlier. As I studied that problem over the 4 or 5 days that I was there, one thing that came to me over and over again, and while we can never excuse the violence, the violence is wrong morally and it is not sound practically. We must make it clear in every instance that we cannot solve our problem through violence, and if the Negro succumbs to the temptation of using violence in his struggle, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness, and our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. And after we condemn the violence, the destruction of property, which we must do, then we must look for the underlying cause of the riot. And when we look there, we will see an economic basis for it. We will discover that in the Watts area of Los Angeles, thousands and thousands of Negroes unemployed, I went to talk to them, and the one thing they said to me, we want jobs, we want some work to do. And then somebody will say, well, aren't you getting a welfare check? The one thing they will say, we don't just want to run downtown to get welfare checks. We want to work. We want some jobs. And at the bottom of many of the conflicts taking place today in many of our cities is the lack of economic opportunity. Some of it grows out of outright discrimination. But we're gradually moving away from that. Our nation gradually has developed a conscience on the question of employment discrimination. But the tragedy is that just as we gradually stepped out of employment discrimination, we stepped right into automation. For years, we as a people have been denied educational opportunities, not because we didn't have basic intelligence, but because we were denied these opportunities. Inferior and adequate schools, and so often couldn't go to school. We had to get out and pick cotton. We were denied apprenticeship training, and so we were limited to unskilled and semi-skilled labor. And these are the jobs that are now passing away. And so this presents a real problem. The Negro wakes up in a city like Detroit and discovers that he's 28% of the population and 72% of unemployed. This is true all over. Now the church, again the moral guardian of the community, must see this. The church must speak to the power structure of our nation. The church must have the kind of empathy that will see the terrible problem that the Negro faces at this time. So often those who have. I'm not only talking about white persons, now I'm even talking about the middle class Negro. So often those who have forget the have-nots. Jesus tells a beautiful parable in the New Testament. He talks about a rich man named Dives and a poor man named Lazarus. You know the story, Dives ends up going to hell. There is nothing in that parable that says that Dives went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a young man, rich ruler, came to him and raised some questions, and Jesus advised him to sell all. But in that instance, he was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. And if you will read that parable and all of its symbolic structure, it's very interesting to notice the sort of symbolic long-distance call takes place between hell and heaven. It was Dives in hell talking with Abraham in heaven. And Abraham was a real rich man. It wasn't a millionaire in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Dives went to hell not because he was rich. He went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and never really saw him. Michael Harrington, in the book The Other America, calls the poor of our country the invisible poor. Dives went to hell because he allowed Lazarus to become invisible. He went to hell because he minimized the maximum and maximized the minimum and allowed the means by which he lived to outdistance the ends for which he lived. He went to hell because he failed to use his wealth to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. He didn't realize that Lazarus was his brother and that he was his brother's keeper. And somehow a great man is a compassionate man. A great man is a man who has concern for the least of these. And I submit that this is the challenge facing the church, to be concerned as our Christ about the least of these, our brothers and our sisters. And we must do it because in the final analysis we are all made to live together, rich and poor, lettered and unlettered, tutored and untutored. Somehow we are tied in a single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And for some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God made the world. Someday we will learn it. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools, because that is an interrelated structure within reality. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And then he goes on to say, any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And so we are challenged to work on every front of racial injustice, because we are our brother's keeper. And certainly one of the greatest ways the church can do this is to remove the yoke of segregation from its own body. We must still face the fact that all too many local churches are still segregated. 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, when we stand to sing in Christ, that is no east or west. It's still the most segregated hour of America, and the most segregated school of the week is the Sunday school, which means that all too many Christians have had a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Thank God we're beginning now to shake the lethargy from our souls, and we're coming to see that if we are to be true followers of Jesus Christ, we've got to solve this problem, and we must solve it, because it will be one of the great tragedies of history if some future Gibbon or some future Toynbee will be able to write for the history books that it was the Christian church in the South that was the last bastion of segregated power. And so this is our challenge. And certainly we in the Negro community, as we go on in the days ahead in the civil rights struggle, we'll have to move on with discipline and dignity, never slowing up, never relenting, for that would be immoral, but always moving on with a faith and with a method, undergirded by a philosophy. And I've tried to say that that philosophy must be a philosophy of nonviolence, because I think it has power. It has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience, and he just doesn't know how to handle it. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you accept the quiet courage of, you develop the quiet courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense loves to go to jail. But if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, there are some things so precious, some things so eternally true, that they are worth dying for. And if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. He may be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth, some great principle, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right will stand before the door of his life. He refuses to do it because he's afraid. He's afraid he will lose his church. He's afraid that he will even be shot at. He's afraid that his home will be bombed. He's afraid that he will lose his job. He's afraid that he will be stabbed. He's afraid that he will be murdered, and he wants to live a long life. Well, he may go on and live until he's 80, but he's just as dead at 36 as he will be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for what is right, for what is true, for what is just. And this is what the nonviolent creed says, and that is power here. Our power will never lie in rioting, it will never lie in looting, it will never lie in destroying property, it will never lie in shooting anybody. Our power will lie in picking up the weapons of love and nonviolence, and taking our bare bodies and our souls and mobilizing them.
Dear supporters of BLC, if you adore BLC and our free Black history and audiobook content, donate via Patreon or get a print copy of the world-famous art pieces, The Marrow of Tradition by Charles Chestnut and Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, bound together into just one practical book. The Marrow of Tradition by Charles Chestnut and Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, bound together into just one practical book. In the link below.